Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is the New Hampshire Primary News Roundup. Every Friday till primary day, The Exchange will cover the latest in the presidential race here in the Granite State and around the country. We'll talk with state and national reporters, hear speeches and interviews from the campaign trail, and occasionally talk with candidates. And today, with us for the first part of our program is Democratic candidate and former Massachusetts governor, Deval Patrick. He served two terms in that office and then worked for Bain Capital, a private equity firm founded by Mitt Romney. Patrick left that position in order to run for president, jumping into the race late in the process, filing in mid-November, just before the deadline for getting on the New Hampshire ballot. We'll take your questions for Governor Patrick, our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call 1-800-892-6477. And in addition to listening today, you can watch our program on Facebook Live. And Governor Patrick, welcome. Nice to meet you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
So let's talk about that late entry. And I know you've gotten a lot of questions about this on the campaign trail. In December of 2018, you said you would not seek the Democratic nomination in 2020, concerned about what you called the cruelty of our elections process and how it could affect your loved ones. At that time, you also revealed your wife had been diagnosed with early stage uterine cancer. You've said now she's cancer free. That is great
news.
That is fabulous.
Yes, indeed.
Still, that political cruelty that you referred to, Governor Patrick, has that changed in any way? Because you did say you were concerned about how that cruelty would affect your family.
Well, I am, and I think any candidate would be. And thank you again, Laura, for having me. And good morning to all of your listeners. Yes, that is a concern. We have, you know, it turns out a lot of democracy depends on unwritten rules, right? Rules around decorum and respect and restraint. We have a sensational climate for politics today. We treat it certainly covering the White House as a reality TV show, and I think it's a temptation for candidates to go in that direction too. That's not who I am. I'm not sure that's what we need in order to get the kind of change that lasts and in order to heal the country. And as I've watched the field continue to campaign and develop, and many of the other candidates are friends of mine. I've talked to them. I've been concerned that we have been offering, and this is a gross generalization, but either nostalgia, meaning we'll just get rid, as they say, of President Trump and go back to doing what we used to do, which is not what we need right now, or our version of anger and division instead of theirs, which I also think is not sort of misses the moment. And so I think there is still a path. I've always thought there was a path for someone, well, not someone, but for me, where I can demonstrate that I have not just ideas but results, that we've delivered on healthcare expansion and to 99% of the residents of our Commonwealth, that we have a national model on addressing climate change and on and on.
Well, I definitely want to ask you about health care a little bit later. But what about that political cruelty then, Governor Patrick? I mean, you said you were worried about the impact on your family, but you're doing it anyway.
I think, you know, we're going to have to model the kind of politics we want. I always say to people who want to support me, talk to your friends and your neighbors and your coworkers, that cranky uncle you hate talking politics with. And talk to people who don't already agree with us, because we're going to have to model a politics that says you don't have to agree on everything before we work together on anything. That's the kind of politics that got us in the situation we are today. And we're just going to have to withstand the incoming to be an example of a successful alternative.
You mentioned that other candidates in this Democratic field are friends of yours. What is it about this field that you find lacking?
Well, what I was saying earlier, you know, other candidates have great ideas. I have results. I have proof points that these big ideas are actually achievable, and they are achievable by setting ambitious goals, but also bringing in others, people who may not share your view about how to accomplish that goal, people who may not share your view that that's the right goal. But that's how you get change that lasts.
So you're saying the other people don't have the experience that you do in bringing people together, Governor Patrick? I guess I'm wondering, you know, it's hard to keep track of how many people are still running, but roughly 10, what do you offer that they don't?
You know, I have a range and depth of life and leadership experience in government, in the private sector, domestically and internationally, that is unlike anybody else in this race. And so much of that problem solving has been about building bridges to get change that lasts. And, you know, we have a broken political system and democracy. In fact, I'll be saying a lot more about that later on today at an open democracy forum, ways in which we have treated our democracy for a long time as if it would tolerate limitless abuse without breaking, gerrymandering and vote suppression, the amount of money and so forth in politics. We have a broken economy in many respects, notwithstanding the cheery economic indicators.
Jobless numbers came out today, still looking pretty good.
Yeah,
the unemployment rate.
The unemployment is low as long as you count both or all three of the minimum wage jobs that people have to survive. Inflation is low as long as you don't count the cost of housing, education, and health care, right? The very things that enable people the stability to move onto a path of economic prosperity. And so I think, you know, understanding that so many people feel seen, unseen, and unheard. And speaking to them and then delivering for them is different from a perspective of life experience and professional experience for me than for any other candidate in the race.
There's been a lot of examination of this field and putting people in various boxes.
I know. I hate that.
You do. Okay.
I really do.
I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway.
I know. It's tempting.
Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, more in that liberal wing, progressive wing, perhaps Cory Booker, then seen sort of more on the moderate end, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, Joe Biden. I mean, if you were on that debate stage next week, Governor Patrick, and we'll talk in a moment about why you and others are not, where would you sort of fit?
Yeah, you know, I don't fit in a box. Most people don't, to tell you the truth. I understand the expedience of trying to get people into their box, but more and more today, when folks talk about the field, I think a moderate seems to be a progressive who actually gets results. If people keep trying to describe me as a moderate, I'm, you know, 99% of the people in Massachusetts have health care. We're talking about trying to get health care to people. We've actually produced that outcome. And somehow having an idea without a result makes you a progressive. Having an idea where you have delivered on the result makes you a moderate. So I'm not sure that the numbers quite work. I mean, I think that this is the time for big, bold ideas. This is the time to challenge the gap between our reality and our national ideals of equality, opportunity, and fair play. That's been my life's work, whether in the private or the public sector.
Let's talk about healthcare, Governor Patrick. Yeah. Since you've mentioned that a couple times, you have said you aren't a fan of Medicare for All. And as you noted, you were governor of a state known for Romney Care, considered the model for Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. So first, let's just get you on the record. Is it correct to say you oppose a single-payer system and would rather stick with the Affordable Care Act? Is that correct?
No, that's a false choice. I think the next thing we should do is a public option. If that public option is Medicare, that's totally fine with me. But the reason I go there is because I think there is a value in having the creative tension between private insurance, which you better believe is going to be trying to figure out how to develop some product to compete for all the people who would move to that low-cost or no-cost public option. And that's good because it puts pressure on system costs to come down. And I think having the pressure on Medicare to innovate is a good thing, too, because, frankly, if you are eligible for Medicare and you can, most people will buy a supplemental policy on top of that because in the private market, right, because Medicare doesn't get the job done. So I think that's the way to get the best of both, pressure in the private insurance industry to reduce system costs and therefore price to consumers, and some pressure on the public side to step up its game.
So is that sort of Medicare for all who want it, like Pete Buttigieg says?
Well, I don't have a slogan. You know, I'm open to any design of that public option that could work. And we may well get to fully publicly funded insurance one day. Most of the countries that do so also retain some version of private insurance, but that tends to be only for the rich.
You served on the boards, Governor Patrick, of a telemedicine company and a pharmaceutical firm, American Well Corporation and Global Blood Therapeutics,
yes,
respectively. How does that involvement with the private sector in healthcare shape your views on the nation's healthcare challenges?
Yeah, actually, I got a couple of insights. These were since I've left office. But American Well is a telehealth company that is developing a strategy for delivering low-cost healthcare, frankly, to anyone. But I think about that as a solution to some of the needs in rural communities, in small towns, and so on. Again, policy doesn't live for most people in silos. It works when it's interconnected with other policies. So, for example, we can have low-cost healthcare delivered by telehealth, but not if you don't have access to broadband. Right.
Well, that's an issue.
So we have to pay attention to that.
Hampshire.
It's an issue all over America. And it's not about, being able to watch great TV anymore. It's about being able to access the global economy, to access healthcare needs, educational needs as well. So I think we have to be active on multiple fronts. In the case of GBT, this is a company that is developing
Global Blood Therapeutics.
Yes, indeed. I'm sorry. Global Blood Therapeutics. This is a company that has developed a therapy for sickle cell, which is one of the diseases that has been ignored, frankly, by public health investments over a long period of time. And on the way to developing that therapy, apparently has developed, if not a cure, at least a way to assure that it is a chronic disease and not a killer.
Sickle cell, by the way, correct me if I'm wrong, Governor Patrick, more affects African Americans, right? So is
exactly
that why it's been ignored
exactly
by the health
that's
community?
That's the only good explanation.
So you said policy shouldn't exist in silos, talking about, you know, having some private involvement, some public involvement. But as you know, Governor Patrick, a sizable chunk of the Democratic electorate is very critical of the impact the for-profit sector has had thus far in American healthcare. They point to unaffordable medicine, pushing opioids on the public. What's your message going to be to those voters who say, uh-uh, the profit motive has not been good for American healthcare, and it should just butt out?
Well, they're right about a lot of that. There's no doubt about it. You know, the pressure to, or the, if it's pressure, is that the right word? The instinct for charging so much for certain drugs, and I'm, you know, there's no explanation for the creep who bought the insulin company and jacked up, once it was generic, and jacked up the price to a point that was completely unreasonable for anybody. But for drug discovery, what we've done over time is drain public resources from investing in basic science. And that research, paid for by all of us, is until the point of commercialization, was one of the ways that drug prices were moderated in the past, so that when it was time to commercialize, the investment by that private entity was a fraction of what it has to be today. The other thing we do is that we have concentrated all that investment in the United States and the recovery of that investment in the United States instead of spread it over the global market, which is where it belongs. So I think part of the answer is the ability of government to source from multiple markets where prices vary. That has been prohibited for a long time in the United States, as you know. And the other is to put the government back in the business of funding basic research so that we go further on the path of commercialization with all of us sharing that burden instead of just private investors.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Your chance to get some questions in for Democratic presidential candidate Deval Patrick, a former two-term governor of Massachusetts. You can send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Again, exchange at nhpr.org. One or two more questions, Governor Patrick, please,
sure.
about your work in the private sector.
Sure.
Your work at Bain Capital, a company, took some heat from President Obama, a good friend of yours.
Indeed.
When he was running.
I was co-chair of that campaign.
So he said pretty successfully that, look, this company buys and sells businesses for profit at the expense of workers. It doesn't care about people. It doesn't care about its employees. Now, this is before your time at Bain, but you have defended your work there, basically saying your role was a force for good. So how so?
Well, so I went to Bain Capital to start a new business to invest in businesses for social and environmental good. And the reason I did that is because I wanted to prove that this notion of having to trade financial return for social responsibility was a false choice. So we invested in companies like one that diverted green waste from landfills, which would otherwise break down and create methane, a greenhouse gas, and instead recycled it and sold it back as a composted soil and ground cover. We invested in a company that was delivering high-quality dental services to poor kids, which is a big, big gap in our healthcare system and a very inconsistently addressed one, and doing it in a very dignified, very cost-effective way that could scale, actually kind of fun way. A company called Rodeo Dental. We invested in a company that was building, and by the way, these are not startups. These are smaller companies that are trying to scale. And we invested in a wonderful company called, creating tech hubs up to 150 in cities and towns, small cities and towns whose downtown had been hollowed out, and using those tech hubs as a place, as a lower cost alternative to offshoring the outsourcing that big companies do of their tech needs, and helping to catalyze the revitalization of downtowns, places like Mobile, Alabama, Fort Wayne, Indiana, and so forth. So terrific companies, very mission-oriented, who, just like any other company, need capital to scale. And being able to demonstrate at scale that you don't have to trade return for impact, measurable, positive impact, raises some unavoidable questions for business generally. And I'm really, really proud of that work.
So one more question on this. Because of your background, not just at Bain, where you described what you did, but you also worked at Coca-Cola and Texaco, served on those corporate boards that I mentioned in healthcare. Given that background, Governor Patrick, what's your view on calls from many Democratic candidates to raise corporate taxes, to increase regulation on corporations, and so forth? There's a very strong anti-corporate message from some of these candidates.
I'm not sure that's anti-corporate. First of all, taxes should go up.
So you think corporations should pay more?
Of course. You know, the consensus in the business community was 25% as a competitive rate. It was the administration that decided to go to 21. And then they didn't finish the work, which is to eliminate all the loopholes that enable some of the most profitable countries in the world to pay zero in taxes. And the loopholes, remember, are argued as a way to give so-called relief to companies who are paying an uncompetitive rate. Well, if you move the rate to what is competitive, you don't need the loophole anymore, and the revenue picture changes dramatically.
So, agreeing with the other Democrats there that corporations should be subject to more taxes and more regulation.
Of course, I mean, I think, look, most of the corporations I've worked in, and that you mentioned Coca-Cola and Texaco, where I was employed to fix broken hiring and promotion systems and make them fair. Institutionalize that fairness. I'm very proud of the work there as well. Most corporations just want to know what the rules are, and they want the rules to be consistent. Not all, but most. And business has a lot to answer for, The capitalism we have practiced in the United States in the last 40 or so years is a very short-term, very shareholder-focused, if you will, extractive kind of capitalism. I'm painting with a broad brush, but there's a lot of evidence of this. And this notion that we should have a long-term view of value is not, to the point I was making earlier about my own business, not inconsistent in the least with return to shareholders. But it means paying attention in real time to the interests of stakeholders, of employees, of community members, and the environment. That's how it ought to be. And frankly, it's the short-termism of business that has leaked into the way we govern ourselves, right? We govern ourselves from election cycle to election cycle or news cycle to news cycle and not from generation to generation. And that has got to change. That's why I ran for governor in the first place, and that's how I tried to govern.
I want to ask you about a major challenge that anyone who is elected president will face, and I think you know where I'm going, Governor Patrick. That's foreign policy, a time of global turmoil, extreme tensions in the Middle East after the killing of Iran's top general by American airstrikes. Then the Iraqi parliament, as you know, Governor Patrick, voted to say that American troops should leave. If you were president, would you say, okay, Iraq, we're going home?
I'd love to be able to say that. And certainly I'd want to say that if I felt that we were leaving stability and security behind. I don't have enough information to give you a definitive answer on that question, but from a distance, it does not seem like we're leaving stability and security behind. You know, we have a... I think, first of all, America has the right and has to reserve the right to protect its interests anywhere, anytime. But I think that right has to be bound by certain norms, international norms, by law, and by forethought. And I think one of the reasons I've been so concerned about the events of the last several days is that we have a leader today who has shown absolutely no interest in those boundaries, doesn't seem to be interested in thinking a step or two or three ahead about what the consequences of his actions will be on our own interests, on our own men and women in the military, or our allies, for that matter. And so I think you can expect a different kind of leadership from me. You can expect that we will build and rebuild our relationships with allies, current ones and new ones. And that just as I used to say to business people when I would take them on trade missions, that you have to make friends before you make money, you have to make friends before you are secure as well.
Let's take a call, Governor Patrick.
Yeah.
And I want to remind everybody, you can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org. Bruce is calling from Bristol. Welcome, Bruce. You're on the air.
Hi, Bruce.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Governor.
Good morning.
Quick question. I'm aware of your initiatives to try to bring Palestinians and Israelis together through
yes.
entrepreneurial activities. Could you talk a little bit about that and how you think that solving the Gaza situation might bring peace to the larger region?
Bruce, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you for that question. So Bruce is referring to something called Our Generation Speaks, Laura, which is an initiative started by a former Israeli military officer who was at school at Brandeis, whom I met near the end of my time as governor. And he'd grown up in a very conservative community. He had a cartoon view, if you will, of Palestinians. And
what does that mean?
Well, it means he had a one-dimensional view. He didn't know Palestinians. He had the picture that was painted for him by popular culture, or by the media, or by the military, and he found in the course of his surveillance work, I remember him describing it. He said, "You know, they're just like me. They were living lives just like me. They were trying to figure out what was for dinner, just like me." And he said, increasingly, he was concerned that his generation needed to build what he described as an infrastructure of hope. And so he came to me with the idea, he was then a student at Brandeis, he came to me with the idea of creating an initiative that brought young Israeli and young Palestinian entrepreneurs together in a competitive summer at Brandeis, where they would work on business ideas, they would call them down, and then have teams of both Israelis and Palestinians on those new businesses.
It kind of speaks to the experience that you've talked to me about so far this hour, which is bringing some of that private sector to sensibility or knowledge or experience to these public sector problems.
Well, look, it's about building bridges. It's about giving people opportunities to know each other, and then they go back and launch these companies in the region. And I will tell you that when I was the founding chair of the advisory board. We took the board across 2 or 3 years ago, I think we were in our third cohort at that point. And And in the debrief, when we had everybody, after we had everybody together in Bethlehem, we were asking ourselves whether the measure of success was the success of the ventures or the success of the relationships. And I think a lot of us came away thinking it's the power of these relationships that in the end will produce a reason to hope.
Thank you very much for that call. And I did want to ask you something, Governor Patrick. We referenced earlier your position in this race, the other candidates, the debate stage. And as you know, diversity has been a major theme in this Democratic primary. And for a time, the party congratulated itself and said, hey, America, look at this great diverse slate of candidates. Now, again, as you know, two candidates of color have dropped out, Kamala Harris and Julian Castro. Senator Cory Booker did not qualify for the last debate, and it looks like now at this point he and Andrew Yang will not qualify for next week's debate. How do you view this pretty dramatic decline in diversity in terms of who is on that stage?
Well, I think that I want to separate the debate from the field because they're both concerning. The debates are, you know, that's a, I don't know if you've watched them.
I want to qualify,
but I'm not sure I want to go because
Now, hang on. You want to qualify, but you're not sure you want to go?
Yeah. I mean, have you seen them? Just as a means to communicate constructively with voters about where what your positions are, it's been subpar, let me put it that way. But I want to qualify because it's one of those winnowing things that we do. It does not reflect the diversity of the field, and that's kind of the point. I think the point of your question, the field is more diverse than those on the debate stage. I'm not sure, by the way, that the polls reflect where people are in the race. It's a very wide open race, and lots of undecideds. They outnumber almost every other candidate. But I think, you know, it is worth examining the format as well as what it as well as the qualifications for being in the debate, if in fact all this talent, much of it diverse, isn't seen on a nationally televised platform. That is not who we say we are as a party, and that is certainly not what the country is becoming.
Well, how much of a role do you think, Governor Patrick, money has played in this? Some are saying, hey, why is Tom Steyer up there, who's never held office, but he's a billionaire? Then you've got Kamala Harris, served as AG for the country's largest state. You know, a woman in the U.S. Senate, a woman of color in the U.S. Senate, that's noteworthy. She's not there. So what's the role of money in this?
What do you think? The money is a distorting feature of our politics generally. And I think, you know, one of the things I have come to learn is how money early invested, and I think the term is people purchasing small dollar donors. You actually, there's a
yes,
there's
I've heard
an
of
amount
that.
Of money you spend in order to get the small dollar donors. It's a diminishing return, but if you spend a lot of it early. So my point is, it has distorted the way some of the campaigns have run themselves, what they've raised and how they spent what they raise in order to be on the debate stage. And you know, there's something, I'm sure it was well-intended. I'm sure all of these criteria were intended to make a very big field narrower as we got close to voting. But I'm not sure it's actually, it served its intended purpose or may have cost us more than it was worth in the end.
Real quickly, Governor Patrick, yeah. And I apologize, we have to let you go. But I did want your thoughts on the New Hampshire primary.
The best.
How you've been experiencing it.
Yeah.
You know, Michael Bloomberg is saying, forget you, New Hampshire, but you're embracing it.
I am. I love New Hampshire and I love the primary here. It's very intimate. And I've been to I don't know how many house parties or smaller forums, just meetings with groups of interested voters, and voters expect that of you. And they engage. They are informed. They have met other candidates. They want to know not just where your positions are, but who you are. And I've enjoyed it enormously.
Where are you heading to next today?
I am headed to Dover for a forum on open democracy. I'll be down in the Portsmouth area today and then back again on Monday.
Okay. Yeah. It was really nice to meet you. Thank you for coming on
today.
I appreciate it. That's Democratic presidential candidate Deval Patrick, former governor of Massachusetts. Coming up, we will continue our New Hampshire primary news roundup with two observers who know the primary well. So stick around. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, it's the New Hampshire Primary News Roundup. Every Friday till the primary, we'll bring you the latest from the campaign with state and national reporters, speeches and interviews from the field, and occasionally candidates who are here in the state. And let's hear from you. If you're a Democratic primary voter, have you decided on a candidate yet? If not, what's going to help you make up your mind? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. For the next half hour, I'm sitting down with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Dean, great to see you.
Hi, Laura. Good to see you.
And also with us, Nicole Skanga. She's 2020 campaign reporter for CBS News. She's based in Manchester. And Nicole, really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Great to be here.
Well, and Dean, we just talked with Governor Deval Patrick. And I know you had a chance to sit down with Governor Patrick for your Pints in Politics.
Yeah, right before Thanksgiving.
And we put a link on our website, so folks want to watch that, nhpr.org/exchange. Anything jump out at you, Dean, from that interview that we just had with Governor Patrick?
Well, it was interesting listening to him 6 weeks out from our interview. He had just gotten into the race at the time, so I think he was a little bit better sense now of what his enterprise is in terms of running for president. He mentioned that he was an Obama campaign chair in the past, in 2012 for sure.
Yeah, I had forgotten about that, actually.
He really comes out of that same tradition. He's close with President Obama. I think he's trying to do something similar by appealing to both progressives and centrists. That's a very difficult, tricky undertaking to pull off. But you heard a little bit of that in what he was discussing today. You also saw he continues to be challenged on his work for Bain. In fact, when he got into the race, most of his interviews that first week were almost completely about his business experience and his ties with Bain, et cetera. So that's something he's going to have to continue to answer. He's got a new commercial up with his wife discussing her bout of cancer, her encouraging him to get into the race, even though, in his words, he's about a year late. He talks a little bit about his childhood in Chicago and that people shouldn't write him off as an underdog. So he's going to have some real challenges, I think, with this late entry. And I'll give you one thing that jumped out at me. You know, there's been a lot of discussion within the Democratic Party, particularly about these national debates and the increasing lack of diversity at the top of the top of the front runners, mostly older white men. And when I talk to Democrats, a lot of them who lament this loss of diversity, they lament Kamala Harris getting out of the race. They lament Julian Castro getting out of the race. They talk about they're disappointed that Cory Booker is not getting more traction. Nobody has mentioned Deval Patrick to me yet. So I think there's an opportunity
for him.
He's just
not well-known.
He's just not well-known. He's late to the race. He's not part of that conversation. And so I think that's symptomatic of the challenges he faces getting traction. That said, he's a very experienced politician, very savvy political operator. He certainly has an opportunity here to fill that void to some extent, but he's got his work cut out for him.
Okay, well, I'd like to ask you and Nicole about the latest from the presidential primary. And wow, there's a lot to catch up on. Hard to believe it's about a month away. Nicole, how are candidates talking to you about rising tensions with Iran? What are you hearing from candidates and voters on this?
Well, definitely what I'm hearing from voters is that they're paying very close attention to this. And it's to the benefit of, I think, two veterans in this race. Former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Congresswoman from Hawaii, Tulsi Gabbard. Both of them are, of course, veterans. And in the case of Representative Tulsi Gabbard, she's the only Iraqi war veteran who has served overseas in this presidential primary. And I attended maybe three or four of her town halls just last week, where the majority of the conversation was focused on foreign policy. And what's really interesting about listening and speaking with voters at her event, I get the sense from Democrats that, of course, we don't want yet another war, another foreign conflict overseas. And of course, we know that New Hampshire is 10% veteran. So lots of people telling me they have family deployed. They have family that has been deployed overseas. They don't want to watch that happen again. But also I'm hearing from a lot of undeclared voters and even Republicans that they're increasingly concerned about escalating tensions in Iran. So this could possibly, you know, play into the Democratic primary in terms of looking at some candidates that have some more foreign policy experience. A lot of people pointing to Vice President Joe Biden, who certainly had, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq in his portfolio during his time at the White House, who was the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate for several years. But also this could play into the general election as well, with more and more people telling me, even former Trump supporters, that they don't want another foreign conflict.
So that's what you're hearing from voters, and that's super interesting. What about the language, Nicole, that you hear from candidates on this? Who seems to be especially adept at dealing with this moment?
Definitely. Well, certainly two that we just mentioned, former Vice President Joe Biden and former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg. What I keep hearing from candidates is that, of course, General Soleimani was a bad guy.
Yeah, everybody
and people seems are
to be saying
really
that.
Underlining this is a bad man. This is someone who we're not going to miss. But at the same time, was there an imminent attack on the United States that would prompt us to act in self-defense? Because really what we're talking about here, and you've heard it from a lot of candidates, Senator Elizabeth Warren and Senator Bernie Sanders, talking about whether or not this is an assassination. And they've said, yes, it is an assassination. And we've had kind of this back and forth with candidates about whether or not this has been an assassination. But what's really underneath all of that is whether or not the United States violated international law by doing this military attack, and whether or not they needed congressional authorization in order to do that. So really some challenging questions. And, you know, some candidates have sort of avoided calling it an assassination. But it seems to me, especially from the senators in this race, that they feel strongly there was nothing that prompted this attack. And I think also, you know, we've heard directly from there's still five senators in this race, and of course, one congresswoman who have been briefed on this attack, who are saying they don't see enough evidence as to whether or not the United States really, should have intervened there in that
That's
way.
That's interesting. So, yeah, Dean, yeah, interesting the language.
Right.
Do you use the word assassination or not? Do you talk about a violation of international law? Do you talk about congressional approval? How do you hear these candidates navigating this moment?
The key dynamic here with this particular issue is Joe Biden touting his foreign policy decision-making experience and Bernie Sanders saying, yes, that's exactly the problem, is your foreign policy decision-making experience. If you listen to what Bernie is saying on the trail, he's basically rolling back out his criticism of Hillary Clinton and the Iraq war resolution. Bernie's been very consistent. I think he saw an opportunity here to roll out the same kind of criticisms that he used in 2016. And Biden obviously is going to tout his experience. And as Nicole mentioned, Pete Buttigieg is kind of the third person here. He's up running a commercial now where the first frame is him in fatigues holding a long rifle to tout his experience. I think the three of them in particular, Elizabeth Warren, I saw this odd exchange on TV over the weekend where the interviewer kept asking her if Soleimani was a terrorist, and she kept saying over and over that he is part of an organization that the United States had designated a terrorist organization. And so she kept getting asked, is he a terrorist? And she kept saying, well, he's part of an organization that the United States has said is a terrorist organization. I'm not sure why she kept using that specific formulation, but I think it speaks to the difficulty that some of these candidates face. And yeah, obviously, he's a really bad guy. You don't want to be seen as a defending terrorists. On the other hand, you have to strike a balance with some of the other elements in the Democratic Party.
So if she uses that word, terrorist, it's interesting what you
were talking
about.
It was just a really repetitive, specific formulation that she clearly had thought through.
I think I saw that clip as well. So if she or other candidates use the word terrorist, then are they basically saying, yeah, maybe President Trump was right to take out this guy?
They're in a tough position of saying, yeah, it's probably better. You know, they're in this awkward position of having to say, yeah, it's better off that he's gone. On the other hand, they don't want to give President Trump a foreign policy victory. And, you know, and as I said, in the end, Bernie was able to get back out there with his 2016 Hillary Clinton criticism and basically just apply to Joe Biden.
I would have never gotten us in that mess in the first place. That's
exactly. He's been consistent.
So I want to hear from voters, Democratic primary voters, in the 20 or so minutes that we have left. Again, if you're going to vote in the Democratic primary, have you decided on a candidate yet? And if not, what is it going to take to help you make up your mind? Again, our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. And this is the New Hampshire Primary News Roundup, a series we're going to run every Friday on the latest in the presidential primary up until February 11th. And Nicole and Dean, let's take some calls. Steve's in Nottingham. Hi, Steve. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, and thank you for all your attention to the primary. It's our primary concern. I have a very mundane question. I'm looking at the absentee ballots, and they're all out, and it's not secret. And there are 11 candidates for Republican and 33 for Democrat. And what is amazing to me is they're not in alphabetical order. So, for example, on the Democratic one, Elizabeth Warren is at the top. I am simply wondering how they determine what order they are on the absentee ballot and maybe on the voting machine ballots themselves.
Steve, this is a great question. And Dean, this is ringing a distant bell for me, that there was some concern about the tradition of going alphabetical.
Yeah, randomization, right.
Right.
And Steve also points out the other thing that often surprises people when they vote in the primary the first time. You may watch the coverage and only hear about 5 or 7 or 10 candidates. But you can run for president on the New Hampshire primary ballot simply by, you know, doing some paperwork and paying a $1,000 fee. So I can recall some primaries where there would be, you know, 30 Democrats and 20 Republicans, all kinds of people who are doing it for different reasons, in addition to kind of the major candidates. So it is a little bit surprising, but there is a randomization element introduced into the balloting as a result.
Thank you very much, Steve, for raising that point. It's a good question. And Nicole, we talked earlier in our show with Governor Deval Patrick, as you heard, about the declining diversity of the Democratic field. And as you know, just recently, Julian Castro, who dropped out of the race, endorsed Elizabeth Warren. So what's your take on that, Nicole?
Well, certainly a very important endorsement for Senator Elizabeth Warren. Of course, we know that Secretary Julian Castro was very outspoken about the lack of diversity in Iowa, in New Hampshire. We'll see, you know, some of the campaign reporters were wondering if he would, in fact, be campaigning with her in some of the early states. We've yet to see that. Of course, the two of them held a very large rally together in Brooklyn just the other night, had thousands show up for the two of them. And, you know, the Warren campaign has told us that they are going to use Secretary Julian Castro not just as this great endorsement, but really as a surrogate on the trail, who is going to be going to more of these states to campaign on her behalf, especially if she's held up in the Senate impeachment trial come later this month.
Oh,
so
good point.
The
yes.
surrogate game is going to be especially important for the senators. Looking at some of the larger surrogates, we know that Senator Bernie Sanders also has a number of important surrogates in Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for instance. Some of the other senators, of course, we know Senator Amy Klobuchar and Senator Cory Booker have a number of key endorsements, state senators right here in New Hampshire who they've pointed to. But in terms of Senator Elizabeth Warren, we'll see just how critical Secretary Julian Castro is to her campaign. I have a feeling they're going to be sending him to states like Nevada, South Carolina, where his message might resonate a bit more.
That's really interesting. And you raise a really important point, Nicole, that is, at some point, the impeachment trial is going to kick in, and that's going to mean several candidates will not be here on the trail in New Hampshire. So who goes in their stead? Typically, it was, you know, high-level officials, spouses are a big draw, but we could be seeing more people like former candidates like Julian Castro. Coming up, we will take more of your calls. Steve, thank you for that one. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. More news from the campaign trail in just a moment. Stay with us. This is the New Hampshire Primary News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday on The Exchange, we talk with Democratic presidential candidate and Colorado U.S. Senator Michael Bennett. That's Monday morning, live at 9. Today, it's our New Hampshire Primary News Roundup, a special feature every Friday until the primary. If you plan to vote in the Democratic primary, tell us which candidates appeal to you, what it might take to help you make up your mind if you're still undecided. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Nicole and Dean, let's go right back to our listeners. Reeves calling from Wolfboro. Hi, Reeve. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you so much for giving us this chance to talk constantly about these wonderful people. I live in Wolfboro, and I've seen about half of the candidates who are still remaining in the field. I, at this moment, still have Andrew Yang as my number one choice. I love Buttigieg and Klobuchar and Tulsi and Sanders, and Steyer on the climate is crucial. But there's a couple of things I think are really important. I think that Biden's getting all the credit for thinking he's the only one who can beat Trump, and I think he's actually the only one who really can't, because so many people who went for Trump really wanted dramatic change, and any of the Democratic field would bring that. Plus, anybody who wants to see more about Andrew Yang, he's going to be in Wolfboro today at 2 o'clock doing a full town hall, so you get to listen to him at length at the Wolfboro Town Hall. And the reason I like him is he has, as I've heard it, the most interwoven set of solutions for the issues that are hugely urgent. Okay.
All right. Reeve, thank you very much. So that's a vote for Andrew Yang. Reeve has figured it out. Let's go to Dave in Grafton. Dave, good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'd like to say that I am a Tulsi Gabbard supporter. Tulsi has said that it is not her military service alone that qualifies her to be president, but it is a deciding factor for me, and I just think it's really important under the current circumstances to have somebody who has deployed and lived through this, who really knows what is going on the ground and has a vision of how to take us back from the brink of a further conflict.
So foreign policy.
I think she's also very strong on other issues. And she's my preferred candidate.
Okay. It's great to hear from you, Dave. And Dean, we hear from him, as Nicole alluded to earlier, that as foreign policy grows more concerning, voters are paying attention to those candidates who have a strong foreign policy message.
Absolutely. And Tulsi Gabbard has been somebody who has the military background, obviously is a veteran, but has also been very outspoken about a lot of the military activity in the Middle East. Both Andrew Yang and Tulsi Gabbard are candidates who have been able to kind of find their niche in New Hampshire. They're both here very frequently. Gabbard, I think, has moved here temporarily. And she's had some success. She's raised a couple of $1 million. Andrew Yang's fundraising has been very good up until now. I don't think he's qualified yet for the next debate in Iowa, but he has been on the debate stage, I think, longer than people thought he would be. I mean, they're both still facing significant challenges. They still tend to be viewed certainly by the media, but I think also by a lot of voters as kind of niche candidates who are still trying to figure out how to kind of break into that top tier. I don't know that it's going to happen for them, but they're certainly both very active, and they've been part of the conversation. Andrew Yang's universal basic income, this $1,000 a month grant that he calls a freedom dividend, something that's gotten a lot of interest in reporting. It's a novel idea in comparison to what some of the other candidates are suggesting. I think there are some limitations to it from a political strategy perspective. But they both seem to be finding their place in New Hampshire. We'll see what happens after the primary.
Well, and if people want to learn more about those candidates, we interviewed both of them. So you can go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. So we got a caller who likes Yang and has decided. We got a caller who likes Tulsi Gabbard and has decided. Here's an email from Tony who says, I'm voting for Amy Klobuchar. I think she has the character and experience to bridge the grand divide between the parties, and she's a woman. I wish the press would give her more attention. Tony, I just want to say, on our end here on The Exchange, we have made multiple attempts to get Amy Klobuchar on our show in one of our forums. We're still working on that. if they're listening, time is running out. So we really hope to hear from you. And Tony, I sure appreciate the email. Nicole, your organization, CBS, recently released a new poll showing not just the usual, which you would expect from a poll, you know, who voters say they like now, but also on electability. So, you know, who Democrats feel has the strongest capacity to defeat President Trump. So what did you find there?
Well, electability is a really funny word, isn't it? But what we did find is that most Democrats think that, you know, one of their choices probably won't win against President Donald Trump. And what we saw is that only 36% of those voters polled felt that former Vice President Joe Biden would win against President Donald Trump. That number is 33% for Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, 22% for Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, and only 15% for former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
Wait, hold on. This is profound. So just repeat what you said at the beginning of that. Less than half of the Democratic voters in this poll thought that any of these candidates
would
could defeat
probably or win, would probably win against President Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's in part due to the economy. Folks are seeing things going really well. They know that the Republicans have been very busy organizing on the other side. We've seen just how much money the president has been raising since the get-go. Quarter three, I believe, was $150
million. Well, an impeachment has helped money come in for
him. The impeachment has emboldened him in many ways, something that Democratic candidates, you know, we talk about Andrew Yang and Representative Tulsi Gabbard. Both of those candidates have said this impeachment will only help. And so a lot of voters still not too confident in this array of candidates. They say they're personally satisfied by the candidates in the race, but still not sure if any one of them can defeat President Donald Trump. And when we talk about electability, it's kind of a funny word. I like to ask different candidates on the trail during what we call press gaggles or Q&A sessions with them what they think electability means, and everyone always comes back with a different response. New Hampshire voters tend to be political consultants in their own right. So I found more and more voters now, too, thinking not only about their own preferences, but who's going to win in places like Michigan, like Ohio, places in the middle of the country. And for that reason, you had a listener mention Senator Amy Klobuchar. She's been getting some attention on that front, coming from a Midwestern state, Minnesota, where she has won in conservative areas.
So, again, this poll indicates, and, you know, polls have their flaws, indicates that even if somebody likes Joe Biden or likes Amy Klobuchar, they're not really sure if that person can beat President Trump.
And overall, we have seen enthusiasm for each of the candidates go down, unfortunately. That said, we're about a month out now from the New Hampshire primary. Guess how many people say they have definitely decided on their candidate? I'll tell you, it's only 27%.
Whoa.
And
hang
so
on,
this
27%
is,
have
this
decided.
This is historic. This is historic. And I'm sure Dean can speak a little bit to this, but we have never seen this much top-tier jostling, if you will, between the four frontrunners here, Senator Elizabeth Warren, Senator Bernie Sanders, Vice President Joe Biden, and Mayor Pete Buttigieg, still neck and neck, only about a month out from the primary.
Well, that's interesting. And I've heard Governor Patrick on the campaign trail say, Dean, you know, mm-hmm. when people say, how come you got in so late? Isn't it too late? He says, no, look at this large cohort sure. of undecided voters. So, you know, they're waiting for me.
Right. Sure. And we're also going to have an additional test with Mike Bloomberg, who's already spent $100 million.
But not campaigning in New Hampshire.
Not at all. He's starting with Super Tuesday on March 3rd. So that's going to be another whole interesting twist to this. Yeah, you know, electability is an elusive term that political scientists have been trying to nail down for a generation. And I think what you're seeing with that polling that Nicole was talking about is a couple things. You know, it demonstrates how difficult it is to unseat a sitting president and an incumbent president. I can think back at, you know, George W. Bush in 2004 had difficulties. Barack Obama before 2012 seemed to be in jeopardy, and he ended up winning. So there's just kind of a sense that it's just very difficult to pull that off. You know, Democrats, I talked to a lot of Democrats. There is also a little bit in the DA this kind of inherent pessimism about, oh, you know, our side is going to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. You hear that phrase a lot. I think this kind of goes with the territory. And then the final thing that Nicole mentioned is this issue within the party of, you know, should the focus be to have some bold new progressive agenda? Or is the reality that in the end, the general election is simply going to be about anti-Trump forces getting together on who and supporting whoever the nominee is? And that speaks a lot to the debate over what should be the appropriate strategy to win the Midwest for Democrats.
Well, we got one more email from someone who didn't want to give a name, who says, since I can't vote for the candidate I want, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I'll be voting for Bernie Sanders. And certainly Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez has been campaigning for Senator Sanders. Last quick question for you guys. Nicole, you first. What primary-related stories are you going to be watching this weekend and next week?
Absolutely. Just looking to see where the chips fall with so many undecided voters. We're focusing on a couple of issue areas, too, looking at folks who have been impacted by the opioid crisis and addiction, which candidates are talking about it. Just another quick thing to watch, too. When I was with Senator Bernie Sanders, he got 4 questions about jobs in the green economy. So looking at who has responses to that as well.
Oh, that's really interesting. Okay, you have to come back on and tell us about that, Nicole. Thank you very much for being here. I really appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
And Dean, how about you? What are you going to be tracking?
Well, it is so close in Iowa, literally a 3-way split, according to the CBS poll. This is an example where what happens in Iowa may have some kind of a important impact on New Hampshire, and that may shake things out very quickly. So really kind of looking at how the candidates in the final several weeks are splitting their time between the two states.
Okay. And on our end here in the Exchange, we'll be spending part of the hour on Monday with another presidential candidate, Democratic U.S. Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado. You can send your questions in advance for Senator Bennett, exchange@nhpr.org, and join us live for that interview Monday morning live at 9. Thank you very much, Dean, for being here. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Laura.
Okay. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.